This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Travel across Europe is at a standstill for a third day after a volcanic eruption in Iceland has clouded the skies. Flights have been canceled, airports closed, thousands of passengers stranded. Scientists in Iceland are keeping a close eye on a volcano that began erupting on Wednesday. Not only does the ash pose a risk for aircraft, but as NPR's Joe Palca reports, the eruption can cause serious problems in Iceland as well.
It's mainly a case of bad luck that the volcano is causing so many problems for travelers trying to get around Europe. The eruption of Eyjafjallajökull, if you'll forgive my pronunciation, is not terribly large as volcanic eruptions go, and had the winds been blowing a different direction, the world would have taken little notice. But the bad luck continues. Gudrun Nina Pettersson of the Icelandic Meteorological Office says the winds are still westerly.
Which means that the winds are going from Iceland towards the rest of Europe.
Still?
Still, and will be. The wind direction is going to change a little bit, but it's still going to be air going from Iceland down towards Europe.
There is a bit of good news. When we spoke on Friday, Pettersson said the ash cloud wasn't rising as high as it did at first.
The plume yesterday and today has mainly been in the lowest levels of the atmosphere. There seems to be a little bit less ash today than before.
When the ash stays fairly low in the atmosphere, it doesn't travel as far, and it's also possible in some cases for aircraft to fly over it. The Icelandic Meteorological Office also employs geophysicists who are responsible for keeping track of the inner workings of the volcanoes in Iceland. Kristin Vogfjord is one of those geophysicists. She says one of the ways of keeping tabs on a volcano is monitoring how much the ground around it is moving. To do that, they place instruments around the volcano whose location can be measured with extreme accuracy.
One directly south of the volcano and another one north of it.
Vogfjord says for most of this year, those instruments have been moving apart, suggesting the ground underneath them was ballooning out as it filled with magma. After the eruption, that changed.
And in the last 2 days, the station, both of them have moved towards the volcano. So we are seeing that the volcano is subsiding a little bit. It hasn't gotten back to the original position, but it is contracting.
That could be a good thing, since it means the magma that was most poised to burst forth has done so. But there could be deeper magma yet to come, so Vogfjord is loath to make any predictions about when the eruption will stop.
I don't know. It could stop soon or it could continue intermittently for days or weeks. Or I think the last one lasted for about 2 years with quiet periods in between, so it's difficult to say.
Another worry is a larger volcano just to the east called Katla. That's because eruptions from Eyjafjallajökull frequently occur just before eruptions of Katla.
I'm not sure you can assume that Katla will erupt this time, but it's close to being due because Katla erupts about once per century and the last eruption was in 1918.
Vogfjord says for now there are no signs that Katla is going to erupt. Both those volcanoes are covered with glaciers and eruptions can cause massive deadly flooding when the ice melts. But Evgenia Ilinskaya of the University of Cambridge says there's another threat when volcanoes erupt, deadly gases, including gases containing fluoride. Fluoride can be good in small concentrations. It's in toothpaste, but
fluoride is highly toxic. In high concentrations, it starts to replace calcium in your bones.
That's not just bad for people. Livestock can be wiped out by the fluoride from volcanic eruptions. What's an expensive inconvenience for European air travelers can be a deadly menace for people in Iceland. Joe Palca, NPR News, Reykjavik.
The nation's last sardine cannery closed yesterday, the Stinson Seafood Cannery in Prospect Harbor, Maine, laid off 130 workers. But now they're hoping a new owner will use the plant to process some other kind of seafood. Back in the early 1900s, the state of Maine had as many as 75 plants canning the tiny fish. Anne Mostu visited on one of the final days of this way of life in coastal Maine.
The Stinson Cannery sits on the edge of Prospect Harbor, about three-quarters of the way up Maine's coast. You could smell the fish before you even got in the door. Inside, the sound of jangling cans and the smell of fish were overpowering. Mertris Harrington was used to it.
I'm from Subin, and I've always been a fish packer.
Harrington is 77 years old and first started canning sardines at Stinson Seafood when she was 18.
I started in 50, really, but I didn't stay all them years straight steady, because I had children in between.
Harrington wore a hairnet, apron, and gloves as she worked on the assembly line, packing the fish into tiny rectangular cans. Sardines are an oily fish, about 4 inches long, and before they're processed and canned, they're called herring.
Well, I think you have to have a little coordination, getting the fish in the cans right. And see, I've worked on cooked fish, and this is raw fish now. Today, I'm putting steaks in the can, fish, little fish steaks. The girl that's packing with me, she does one can, and she skips a can, and I do that can. That's the way we do the fish.
While it was mostly women packing the fish, men worked at the plant, too, hauling trays and putting them in the steamer, where they were blanched and marinated. The staff of 128 workers churned out about 100,000 cans of sardines a day. Bumblebee Foods, which owns the cannery, attributes the closing to federal regulations that have reduced the catch limits on Atlantic herring. Al West was a fish buyer for the cannery. He says the herring catch limits are half of what they were 6 years ago, and the company could no longer produce enough sardines to keep the plant up and running.
We've been very successful, and we've weathered a lot of storms, but the reduced quota was one that we had no control over.
In this community, there aren't many opportunities for work. Many of the employees had been at the cannery for decades. Mertris Harrington was most concerned about the younger workers.
Well, I think we'll all manage. It's going to be harder on the younger people, I think. At my age, I think I can get by. See, I have my Social Security. No, I don't know. I think it's going to be hard, but hopefully they'll have something come in soon.
Even if there is a buyer, it's unlikely that the cannery will continue to process sardines. But the workers say any jobs will be welcome. For NPR News, I'm Ann Mostu.
This is NPR News. Last week, NPR's Brenda Wilson traveled to southern West Virginia for a story that looked at how conditions in the coal mines affect the health of mine workers. The story brought back memories for Brenda, a coal miner's granddaughter.
Even now, a mine disaster gives me a small phantom tremor. I say phantom because no one in the family works in the coal mines anymore. Once upon a time, all the men did. And what I know of waiting when miners are trapped underground or there's an explosion comes from being a child, watching adults frightened and powerless. My more immediate understanding is of what even a short career in coal mining can do to your lungs. Long before I was born, my grandfather had to leave the mines because it affected his lungs. He moved his family to a small town over the mountains in Virginia, where I was born and grew up. But the rest of his family stayed behind in and around the coal fields of Logan County. I was interviewing someone this week and discovered that he knew them all.
My name's Robert Schultz. Everyone called me Bob. I live at Sharpless.
You live at Sharpless? Sharpless. Now that's a name that took me back. I used to run through those mountain hollows as a kid in the summertime. Bob batted around names that seemed like exotic places, except they were familiar. Dobra, Clothier, Monclo. He knew my cousin Lon, who was a practical joker. One time, Lon was about to set off a blast, and the inspector told him he should shout, "Fire in the hole!" 3 times.
So Lon goes and wires the place up. He brings the cord over, and he puts his "fire in the hole 3 times, good buddy," and shot it off. He's a good man. He was.
That's what he said about my Uncle Frank, too. Uncle Frank died in his 70s, not too long after retiring from the mines. He was a frail figure of a man then, but he'd been really muscled when he was younger. Towards the end, he never seemed to get enough oxygen. And as I listened to Bob, I could hear him struggling for breath as well.
I had to quit in April of 07. I can't breathe.
Bob had been a smoker in his youth, quit, and took up smoking again when he was 30 to ease his nerves after coming upon the body of a miner who'd been electrocuted. Because he smoked, the company won't accept his diagnosis of black lung and pay him disability.
Honey, in this state, nothing's work-related. If you get a rock on top of your head, it fell off an airplane. It flew over the job.
My grandfather never smoked a day in his life, but I do remember that he spent his last days with a racking cough that drained him day by day of his vitality. I'm Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
This is NPR News. When the Pulitzers were announced this past week, maybe no one, including Kathleen, was more surprised than fiction winner Paul Harding. His novel Tinkers was released by a little-known publishing company with few works of fiction. To its credit, it was the first time a book published by a small independent press won the Pulitzer for fiction since 1981's Confederacy of Dunces. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story.
No one notified Paul Harding that he had won the Pulitzer. There was no congratulatory phone call. He wasn't sitting around with a group of friends waiting breathlessly for the news. Harding was alone when he checked the Pulitzer website, curious to find out who had won.
I came as close to actually fainting as I think I ever have, you know, because I literally just could not believe what I saw when it came up on the website. And I kept refreshing the page and, you know, and it just kept coming up. Tinkers, Tinkers, Tinkers.
Tinkers is the story of a dying man and his relationship with his father, who suffered from epilepsy and eventually abandoned his family because of it. After Harding finished writing the book, he sent it out to agents and publishers, but there were no takers.
So I just sort of, you know, put it in the drawer for 3 years, I guess, and just thought, well, this will be one I'll have in the file cabinets, and I just, you know, start working on the next thing. And then it was sort of published more or less through a series of just sort of like wonderful, improbable accidents with the Bellevue Literary Press getting a hold of it and wanting to do it.
The Bellevue Literary Press was not exactly known as a powerhouse in the publishing world. Erica Goldman is the publisher and editor of Bellevue. She and an assistant make up the entire staff, and their office is in a most unusual setting for a publishing company.
Our office is nested within the Department of Medicine at the New York University School of Medicine, which is at Bellevue Hospital, hence our name.
Bellevue is a major center for emergency services in New York City, but it's probably best known in the public imagination as a mental hospital. The Literary Press was established 5 years ago, mainly for the publication of high-end medical books. But Goldman, a veteran of the publishing business, is also committed to releasing works of fiction with a scientific or medical theme. A publishing colleague who had passed on Tinkers because it didn't seem right for his company thought it might work for Bellevue, so he gave a copy to Goldman.
It just leapt off the page. You know it when a manuscript arrives that is several cuts above the norm, and this was it.
Goldman ordered a first printing of 3,500 copies. Then a sales rep in San Francisco fell in love with the book. She got the book buyer at the independent bookstore Book Passage interested, and she brought Harding out west for a signing event. He began visiting other bookstores and started getting invited to book clubs.
So I went to people's houses and hung out with groups of, you know, 8 to 12 people and sat in people's living rooms and, you know, talked about the book and art and all sorts of pleasant things.
The book also began to get some glowing reviews in publications like The New Yorker. Goldman says that ephemeral word-of-mouth buzz began to build.
This is a real phenomenon. It's not hyped. It's not heavily marketed and spun. It's just passionate readers falling in love with a gorgeous work of literature and sharing the wealth.
Eventually, Tinkers had gotten enough attention in literary circles that the Pulitzer Committee called Goldman and asked her to submit it for the award. Still, neither she nor Harding ever expected to win.
When I step back a little bit, you just think, oh, this is one of those really, really cool, wonderful literary anecdotes. But then what's sort of mind-blowing to me is that I happen to be the protagonist.
Even before winning the Pulitzer, Harding had gotten a contract for 2 new books, but not with Bellevue. His new publisher will be Random House. Erica Goldman gave him her blessing, and the Pulitzer, he says, belongs to her and Bellevue as much as it does to him. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Michael J. Fox left high school in British Columbia to become an actor. And when a social studies teacher told him, "You're making a big mistake, Fox. You won't be cute forever," Mr. Fox told him,
"Maybe just long enough, sir. Maybe just long enough."
That is Michael J. Fox joining us from New York. And in the commencement season ahead, this man who so proudly calls himself a graduate of the School of Hard Knocks and the University of the Universal has written a small book aimed at graduates to share some lessons from his life and remind them that education is never over. His book is called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Future. Michael J. Fox, who's won Emmys, Golden Globes, People's Choice Awards for his roles in Family Ties, the Back to the Future series of movies, and Spin City, and of course founded his own foundation for Parkinson's research. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You have given commencement speeches. Do you ever feel a little awkward about that?
I do. I usually open them with, what the hell are you thinking? I've always had a bit of an imposter syndrome when it comes to that because I never finished high school, although I have to correct that. I did get my GED
right.
15 years later at the urging of my 4-year-old at the time, who's now 20 and a college student.
Yeah.
But, I always felt a little kind of short, coming up short in the education department, but I've come to the conclusion we all get an education, and somehow over the years I managed to get one.
Yeah. You thoughtfully break your book down to specific disciplines, just almost as if it's a degree program. Now, for example, the section under economics, you talk about your experience as a young actor in L.A. You were working and successful, but the economics didn't pay off for a while, did they?
Yeah, my idea of what success was, I think the first year in Los Angeles in 1979-80, I probably made about $50,000, but I spent about $75,000. So that was my first lesson in economics. That doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being told that there was something on my limited experience didn't prepare me for this idea of withholding. And I thought, I can either pay my taxes now or pay them later. Well, later works. I'm a young man. I'll be eventually able to do it. I didn't really realize that within a few months they'd be asking for that money.
Yeah.
So that was my lesson in economics. It's kind of the idea of being, when you're an actor, supply and demand means you're the supply, and if there's no demand, you're in big trouble.
Yeah. And you also, every dollar you earned, you had to pay almost half of it to other people. I don't mean just the government either.
No, you have agents and accountants, and there's a whole swarm of kind of a shark, a feeding frenzy that happens around a young actor.
Mm-hmm.
You need all kinds of help, which at least you're convinced that you need all kinds of help.
Yeah.
And that help doesn't come cheaply. So, no, I was paying 20% to a manager, 10% to an agent, 5% to an accountant, and 50% to the government. So that left just enough for plain wrap macaroni and games of Duck the Landlord.
So, and you wind up playing Alex Keaton, a young capitalist.
Yeah, a young Friedman economics major. Someone who loved money. It's ironic that now as I'm a fundraiser for our foundation, some of our biggest supporters are people on Wall Street and in the financial industry, hedge fund managers and stuff that grew up idolizing Alex Keaton. So it's kind of come around in this weird karmic way.
Oh, my.
That these people that I was satirizing end up being my biggest benefactors.
Yeah. You were appearing in Family Ties, which became awfully popular, while you were shooting Back to the Future, which also became awfully popular. But your schedule is almost painful to recall from those days. Do you remember?
I was shooting them at the same time. It's the same kind of way the math didn't work on the economics. The math wasn't really working in a temporal sense when I was doing both those projects at once because I was working from about 10 to about 5 on Family Ties and then from about 6 till 4 or 5 in the morning on Back to the Future. So it left very little time to travel to and from my apartment and get sleep. And I was having a teamster literally pick me up from bed and throw me in the shower and then at the end of the day reverse the process. Take me in and throw me into bed and turn off the lights. And I say in the book, it was kind of this idea that Einstein said that, time is a conspiracy to keep everything from happening at once, so to speak. And that's kind of what was happening. I was trying to make everything happen at once, and it was only that I was so young and willing and eager and ambitious that I was able to accomplish it to a great great success. The directors and the editors and all that stuff really covered my tracks and made it easy for me.
Yeah. Lest people think that the Teamsters have some kind of wake-up service, we'll explain they're the union that runs the livery in Hollywood and really most of the country.
Yeah, you can tell they're kids at the playground because they're the ones watching everybody else play.
Okay, I want it understood you're making jokes about Teamsters. I'm not.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends. They'll understand.
Mr. Fox, you Do you learn more from success or disappointment and even failure?
I think you learn more from disappointment. But I think that success loses its sheen after a while, and you begin to see that there's no such thing as absolute success, mm-hmm. that there's always failure, and there's always disappointment, and there's always loss. But the secret is learning from the loss and realizing that none of those holes are vacuums. They'll be filled up, and if you try to fill them up with ego or kind of immediate gratification, you're going to short shrift yourself, and you're going to lose the opportunity to find out what happens when you give the loss space to fill itself and let life kind of come in and fill the cracks.
Yeah. We're speaking with Michael J. Fox. He has a new book out, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Future. You do say in the book that you've learned from your illness.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm like, for example, right as I speak to you now, I'm waiting for a pill to kick in, which is not helping me out and not kicking in. And they kind of go on their own schedule.
Yeah.
And so I have a choice. I can either kind of quit and say, well, you know, this is not ideal. I'm gonna give in. Or I can just push through. The thing about that I was trying to explain to people, because so much of the time, actually, my pills are working and I'm feeling great. Mm-hmm. And people say, you look so good and you look so smooth. And I have to remind them and myself that when I am smooth and I am, the medication is working, that's not my natural state. My natural state is one that's affected by the shortage of dopamine production in my brain. So my natural state is to be halting and at times tremulous and kind of just physically disturbed. I mean, that's my natural state given the situation in my brain. But I'm always as happy either way. And so when it comes to me, body language lies.
You talk about your friend and mentor, Gary Goldberg, with whom you did Spin City. And he's told you, I guess, a while back, not so long ago, that he's learned how to bend time now.
Yeah, I had this really nice coffee with him one day. And he talked about he being up in Vermont with his wife, Diana. And he's really slowed his output down and is not working as much by design. And he had said that he was talking about this new life he's formed with Diana. And he said that exactly that. He said, we found a way to bend time. And I thought that was so sweet. And I thought, I hope in 10, 15 years that my wife Tracy and I will be able to conspire in the same way to make some space for ourselves and make a life for ourselves outside of the expectation of others and just, you know, enjoy that kind of peace.
Mr. Fox, can I ask, do you think people have expectations of you?
It doesn't really matter because I think they may, but I'm pretty set on my path and pretty comfortable with what I'm doing, and I have enough experience to know that I seem to be pleasing the people who I most want to please, and when I'm not pleasing them, I'm learning from their disappointment, and it's pushing me in the right direction. So I don't burden myself too much with others' expectations or even my own expectations. I think your happiness grows in direct proportion to your acceptance and inverse proportion to your expectations. It's just a matter of putting one foot in front of the other or doing the next right thing, so to speak.
Mr. Fox, I can't thank you enough for speaking for us now. I'm very
grateful. Pleasure. Again, I'm sorry that it's so halting. Well, next time I catch you, maybe the pills will be working. But I've enjoyed the conversation. Thanks very much.
It's been an honor to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
And you can read an excerpt from the new book by Michael J. Fox, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Future, and hear more of our conversation with him on our website, npr.org. Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Wall Street is reeling from fraud charges leveled against Goldman Sachs by the Securities and Exchange Commission. In a civil suit filed yesterday, the SEC alleges the giant bank created and sold mortgage investments it knew were shoddy and likely to collapse. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports on the federal government's first major enforcement action stemming from the subprime mortgage crisis.
The complaint alleges a scheme that worked like this. Goldman created a mortgage investment deal at the request of John Paulson, a hedge fund manager who made billions betting the real estate market would tumble. Goldman let Paulson select mortgage bonds that were likely to go sour and package them into investments. But the foreign banks, pension funds, and others who bought them were not told of Paulson's role, nor were they told that Paulson was betting against the investment.
These are pretty egregious facts in terms of the scope of the fraud.
Jill Fish is an expert in securities regulation at the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
According to the allegations, Goldman was manufacturing a product that it knew would fail and selling that product to investors. And that goes a lot further than the role we've understood the investment banks to have played.
Investors lost more than $1 billion, while Goldman and Paulson profited. Paulson was not charged with fraud, but one Goldman executive was, Fabrice Touré. He allegedly played a major role in structuring and marketing the investment. In emails obtained by the SEC, Touré was boastful. "The whole building," he wrote in French, "is about to collapse any time now. Only potential survivor, the fabulous Fab, standing in the middle of all these complex, highly leveraged, exotic trades he created without necessarily understanding all the implications of those monstrosities." 3 exclamation marks followed. Yesterday, Goldman Sachs released a statement saying the SEC's charges are completely unfounded in law and fact, and the company would vigorously contest them and defend the firm and its reputation. Earlier this year, the firm's chairman, Lloyd Blankfein, responded to questions not about this case, but about the way Goldman marketed mortgage-backed securities. The questioner was Phil Angelides, chairman of a federal panel investigating the causes of the financial crisis.
Was your due diligence adequate?
Well, that could be...
I mean, did you scour loan tapes? I guess at one point... Do you have a responsibility? What is the sense of responsibility?
Well, we have a responsibility to be open and to tell people what they're having.
Some analysts believe the government could have a difficult time proving that Goldman wasn't open and honest, in part because of the way the bonds were selected. Nonetheless, Brad Simon, a former federal prosecutor who now defends companies accused of white-collar crime, says Goldman should be worried about the SEC matter and about a possible criminal prosecution.
I would be very concerned if I were Goldman. The fact pattern as it's been outlined in the SEC complaint is really quite extraordinary. They're so bent on making profits any way they can that they're actually putting their own clients at risk.
Whatever happens in the Goldman Sachs case, the spotlight will remain on Wall Street bankers as Congress considers tougher regulations for financial institutions. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.